I mean, review the language the Buddha used, the images, the metaphors, the themes he referred to continually that have become standardized in our Buddhist tradition. Also in the way our minds work, often images of journeys, paths, development as a positive quality, and also an endless journey, samsara, as a very negative quality. Something just goes spinning round and round like wheel spin, doesn't actually go anywhere. Whereas the Dhamma is a wheel that does go somewhere. Mm. And these two different kind of movements, you could say. Yeah. And you've got to bear both of those in mind. It's clearly, we can see the fruitless just churning around, goes to the same old thing, day in, day out, the same habits. Is the wheel spin of samsara. But to not get your tracks on the ground and to make fruitful development is also inertia. We don't get off the wheel just by going inert. So this sense of right effort, right application, even desire, chanda, motivation. Mm-hmm. And these are the sense of chanda and motivation and fruition. It's always a difference. Is this is really about the cultivation or bringing into being fruitful states. Bhavana. So the term that covers everything that we are involved with in a Dhamma is called bhavana. And everything that's samsara is called bhava. So you see the terms are pretty close. The bhavana refers to the process whereby skillful states are kindled, aroused, accumulated, nourished, and lead onwards. Mm. You know, I have the image is one of something that flows. And bhava is associated with something that's driven by blindness and ignorance, not by skillful states. One of the most beautiful poetry, renditions. This simile, this image of the upward flow, I'll call it to be brief, is seen in many suttas present, not just do one thing, but when you develop this, this leads to that. When you develop this, it leads to that. If you linger with this, it gives rise to that. And this process, you can trace this process in a number of ways. And one of the images that's used to encapsulate that is of rain falling on a hillside. When rain falls on the hillside, it moves into the gullies. When it fills the gullies flow up and become creeks. When the creeks become full, they flow in and become rivers. When the rivers become full, they become lakes. When the lakes become full, they overflow into great rivers. And when they become full, they merge into the ocean. So this is the way the Buddha said the process of skillful states begins and is moved along from this shore to the other shore, into the language that's used. In this sense of things have to ripen and become full and rich. When they're ripened and full and fed, they naturally swell and overflow into something grander till you get something that's absolutely beyond limit. So this is the image that's used. It's a lovely opening, widening sense that you get with it. And another teaching, he says, when you cultivate like this, you don't need to make a particular volitional effort. So he says, for example, if you linger on the quality of virtue and integrity and non-regret, non-remorse, there's a gladness that arises, like a relief and a gladness. Yeah. like one is let out of jail, that kind of feeling. If you linger on that quality of gladness, then joy arises. One feels uplifted, like, oh, well, wonderful. You know, I've moved away. If you linger on that, the body begins to feel comfortable and restful and at ease. If you linger on that, the heart becomes happy, at ease, steadied. If you linger on that, it becomes concentrated, samadhied. If you linger on that, vision, knowledge arises. If you linger with that, without any further push, you see things as they really are, become dispassionate and released. Yeah. So these are these kind of images and presentations of a flow process in which there is definitely a movement, but it's a movement that doesn't require constant pushing. In fact, pushing will harm it. And yet, it's not inertia either. There's a careful gathering and staying and lingering and dwelling in fruitful conditions, and the mark of them is they are happy. And that's a really, I think it's such an important, if you just remember that bit and try to cultivate that bit, that's in a way, that's the kind of, you look into the actual living human territory of the Buddhist tradition, it's basically happy. It's devotional, it's glad, it's generous, it's sharing, it's of that nature. You know, you look into Buddhist assemblies, congregation are happy, they're glad, they rejoice. When you come into well-trained places where people have cultivated the way, the monks and the nuns are happy. They're pleased with each other's company, they feel what a blessing it is. Yeah. I think this is really so important. Yeah. Because, you know, it's a widening out of yourself into something bigger. Not out, even out of your personal self, but out of the world that your personal self creates, which is, I'm alone, I'm an individual, I'm independent, I'm supposed to get it all together, I've got to be as good as the next person, perhaps better than the next person, so I won't be left behind, accused, attacked, laughed at, left out, missed the opportunity. You know, I don't want to be like, so therefore I will push. Louder? Yeah. And that becomes such a standard thing, it doesn't even become a thought. It's just a basic energetic pattern that to do something you strain. You don't linger and allow, you strain. To put your heart, make an effort means to strain. And so that gets mixed up with effort, you know. Effort equals strain. Right, effort is a real strain. And the more effort you make, the more strained you get, you know. And that's worldly effort. Yeah. But when we consider what right effort is based upon, it's based upon right view. Right view, it has several features to it. First of all, it's not really about, it's about just surveying and lingering in a vision of what kind of states are good and worth being with and what are not good and not worth being with. Could sum it up like that. And it's also about relationship. There are other beings, there's mother, there's father, there's someone else. So it's very much embedded in the learning program of the human world in the time of the Buddha. So you survey a whole field of thoughts and impressions and comings and goings, and what do I get out of this? What's the general picture? These go that way, these go that way. And in a sense, that vision is not so much a fine detailed scrutiny on a particular thought or an idea, how brilliant it is, or how, you know, or even what I should do, but just to sort of step back and survey the ethical and hedonic results, and the two are together. If they're skillful results, they lead to something agreeable. So we're kind of just lifting off the details of what we're thinking about to the general process of it. Does this whole thing, whether I'm thinking about cows or children or business or whatever, is my mind, is my heart comfortable with that? Or is it fretful, hostile, harsh, worried? You know, so that's right view. And you can see already I've started to introduce this word heart, because again, this is a big shift that I think we need to bear in mind. Is there's quite a distinction between the learning program of the heart and the learning program of the intellect. By and large, the conscious learning program of the intellect that we undertake in our current society is to do with symbols and concepts, how to organize five of these, how many of these lead to that, what's this program do this, and so forth. We learn a lot, abstract knowledge, symbols, concepts, management, engineering, ideas, physics. That's what we learn in school. That's our learning program. That faculty called manas, which is the organizer of thought, is the dominator. Now, if you go back to 5th century BC India, very little writing, no schooling, no engineering, very few concepts. You have family loyalties, you have sky, you have devas, you have animals, you have forests, yeah. You have sickness, you have death, you have possibles of demons and angels, and you have sages and summoners have gone forth. That's your learning, that's your book, that's your learning, that's your academy. Yeah, it's all very tangible. Yeah, it's all frightening and rejoicing and gladdening and comforting. It goes straight to the heart. It's very direct. You go forth, you go to live in a forest. Yeah. When you go to live in a forest, you can't have a lot of ideas in your head about how, you know, what's going to happen when you get to the other side of the forest. You've got to have all your senses open, your thinking mind, your visual faculties, your hearing, your smelling, your tactile faculties, your bodily sensitivity and balance, all of them running, and not be involved with any of them, so you can survey the signals that are coming in. Here's alarm, here's temerity, here's impatience, here's a danger signal. Surveying internally and externally what arises in the citta. Right? What arises in the citta that give me the signal of fear or of craving? Because if I follow those, I'll get mesmerized and I'll lose the balance, the overall picture. So the aim is to understand these signs that arise in the heart. Craving, impatience, worry, doubt, not thoughts, but emotional pushes and triggers, and to not get involved with any of them, but to certainly acknowledge their presence. And maintaining the overall balance. Yeah. So in this way, then, one is extremely concentrated, but you're not concentrated on anything apart from being balanced and open and awake. Right? What can do that? Now, what I'm suggesting is that one of the very most common words in the Buddhist scripture, citta, can do that. Citta is that which feels, senses, receives, is receptive, and receives these signals, signs of passion, joy, ease, rapture, inspiration, faith, hatred, receives all these signals, it shivers, and that generates its volition, it moves in those directions. And a skillful person is listening out for the signs of joy, confidence, stability, balance, well-being, and where they're going. Because they're not found in a sight or a sound or a touch or a thought. They're found in the heart itself. And as the heart discards its ignorance, it tunes into those qualities and dwells in them and becomes concentrated, gathered together, one-pointed on those qualities. And these qualities are called skillful because they have a ripening effect. You don't have to push them. When the citta enters something gladdening, it swells. Yeah. Just what it does. That's what the nature of a skillful state. When we enter something frightening, it contracts, tightens up. When you enter something with passion in it, it goes on fire. It rushes out and burns. Yeah. When it comes into bitterness, it turns around and gets sour. So you can contemplate the shaping of the citta. Now, once you get a bit more familiar with the territory, you can recognize when the citta is muddied, or when it's uplifted, it's spacious, it's bright, or it's darkened, or it's shivering, or it's crushed. And all these shapes and forms, and this is your book, this is where you study, and what gives rise to that, and what gives rise to that? And that's the right view. And the Buddha says you have to make an effort for right view. It's not just something that, you know, it means the effort is to restrain the sense faculties, so you're not just following every sign, sight, sound, which is, nor are you blocking them, but you're restraining, so you can, hey, what's the message behind this? No, don't bother with that one. Yeah. This is something to cultivate. It's called restraint. If you're living in the world or anywhere, actually, these days, there's so much stuff coming in, and so you've got to have that sense of, what's this one? This is just another piece of propaganda. This is another rant. This is another gimmick. This is another thing that's just trying to get me stimulated or angry or upset. Don't bother. Yeah. It's just going to poison. So this is called right view, right effort, and then because of that you're both receptive, absolutely, otherwise you can't view anything, but you're also, there's a firmness, you're selective. You say, I receive everything, but these are the ones I discard and this one I stay with. That's called mindfulness. So, in the terms of this ongoing process, the Buddha says, when you've established a sense of view and you've established virtue, then you have a basis for mindfulness, or right mindfulness. So it's both firm and it's receptive. It's like I call it something like a loop. You place it over. These things fit into it, these don't. Okay. And what fits into it is that which gives rise to skillful states. So then if you maintain that careful, sustained loop, then those skillful states that arise will naturally bloom and swell. Right. Now in terms of the thinking mind, this doesn't happen at all, because the thinking mind doesn't do that. Thinking mind, it moves forward, or it moves in terms of sequence. Yeah. From this to that, to this to that. You know, if you like, if you look at the written word and sentences on pages, which now we mostly see, or on screens, it doesn't make sense until you got to the end of the sentence. So your mind skips along to get it. Yeah. Right? da 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 da, and then maybe I need another few sentences to get the full thing. So your mind has to skip along, your eye skips along, da da da. That's the way it's linear. Then you go into a forest, you look at that, okay. You get something more holistic, dark, shady, lively. So it's more holistic opening and deepening and revealing rather than something that moves along. You can stand still and let it keep speaking to you. Right? So that's the learning program of bhavana. It's not this to that to this to that. It's just stay with that, keep taking it in and sieving and filtering, and then this is the good one. Keep opening to that and it begins to shift. Something else comes up. I was telling somebody the other day about the Mandelbrot set, which you might have heard of, whereby this very simple equation is applied time and time again, and a series of results are mapped on a graph, and it produces this endless flow of colours, and every one of them, you look into it, and the same modalities keep recurring and recurring as it opens and opens and opens and opens and opens. And opens. And the fundamental quality that is revealed as the citta opens is the sense of freedom. Oh, what a relief not to have to drag regret and remorse around, not to have to be furtive. Yeah, not to have to be worried about what people think of me. Oy, you know, what happens then? Weight off the back, heart opens. Oh, yeah. And what a joy it is to recognize that my happiness could be right here rather than something I have to reach out for in terms of sense objects or doing something or being approved of. Oh, that's rapture. Suddenly that it's intimate, it brings you back to yourself. You're your own treasure. And that rapture transfers the happiness into the body. The body becomes light, bright, and we feel that heart has now got an easy place to rest in, and that's how samadhi comes around. That's the way it's expressed. And why I mention this, because I do a lot of retreats and so forth, and in that conversation, it's almost always, you know, so repeated. People are straining to get their mind concentrated. They're trying to focus on a particular point and get good at it. And, you know, they say, what point should I focus on? And I say, no point, and they look confused. And how do you concentrate? I said, you don't concentrate, you look very confused. And they say, where should I focus on the breath? I say, you don't do that, and you look confused. And because that's what we're doing, we meditate. And well, maybe that's what you're doing, but the Buddha didn't teach that. They look confused. You know, because the whole, you know, view and the paradigm is that things don't work unless you tighten up. And if you're really sincere and focused on something, you get really tight. And the idea is to get micromanagement tight. That's where you're really top grade, you know. And I guess professional life can do that. That's our training. And of course, this is why we're in a society massively loneliness, addictions, you know, depression, mental health declines, because people are tightening up something that should not be tightened. They're screwing up something that is a delicate, sensitive system that should not be screwed up. They're pushing something that should not be pushed, nor should it be ignored, but to be carefully held and honored and looked after, fed proper food. This is the paradigm, this is the model of bhavana. And of course, there are very, very powerful forces that the citta is prone to. We know the great enemies, greed, hatred, delusion. tanha, craving, negativity, arati, negativity, sourness, bitterness, jealousy. It's all to do with loneliness, isn't it? You know, I'm on my own, therefore I've got to get my thing. I'm on my own, therefore she's got more than I have. Yeah. They're all about the constricted state. of the isolated being who can only find the happiness by gobbling more. It's not going to come any other way, whether it's marshmallows or PhDs, fancy cars or glamorous clothes, power, whatever. And you can see the horrors that come out of that consumer craving. And but one that isn't mentioned in the same light is fear. And fear is actually seemingly even more basic. So when the citta in samsara is always frightened. You don't necessarily recognize it as such because there are ways of numbing out that fear. And the unawakened being generally has security systems and supports that help to take away that anxiety, insecurity, uncertainty. And if we retranslate fear as fundamental insecurity, uncertainty, yeah, and that fabulous minaire, not certain what that does to us, we get rattled, tell me what to do, what time it is, where should I be, what I'm supposed to do, am I doing the right thing, you know, does she like me, you know, what do other people think of me, what am I going to be in 5 years' time, what happens when I get old? You see, the possibilities for uncertainty, anxiety, to downright terror are profound. When the citta is embedded in samsara, it's always fending off fear. That's why it's so glued to craving and aversion. And there's a saying where the Buddha's interviewed by this deva. Deva says, this mind, this citta is always frightened, always running from this to that, looking for security. Tell us, the Buddha, I don't know what he called the Buddha, great Gautama, how do we get free of this fear? And the Buddha says, well, not without enlightenment factors, not without relinquishing all, not without a full awakening do I see any refuge for human beings. Right. You ask. But fear is the kind of one of the fundamental triggers. And so we actually list the things we could feel a bit nervous about. And let's put it that way. Have I made a mistake? Have I offended somebody? Oh dear. The way you can offend people, through a joke or through, have I been politically correct? Mention all the different, you know, categories of people to make sure we haven't seemingly, you know, dismissed anybody, given everybody equal attention and gone and said something wrong, offended, gaffe. Politically incorrect. You know, my name will be broadcast on the internet. I'll be known as someone who believes. Oh, goodness. So that fear, did I turn up at the right time? Everybody looks at me, who's he? Late. Social gaffe. Fear. Have I behaved disrespectfully? I didn't bow 3 times. How many times did I bow? I better bow another time to make sure I've got enough done. Just one for security. You know, otherwise fear of that, fear of being intimidated, fear of intimidating others, yeah. Yeah. Fear of missing out, Fear of being overwhelmed. It's just too much, I'm just going to cave in under the pressure. Fear of being overwhelmed. Yeah. Fear of being left out. When the good stuff's being handed out, I was looking in the wrong direction. Fear of being ignored. Oh, yeah. And you look at these things, oh yeah, these are common, embarrassing phenomena, aren't they? We don't necessarily really see them that way. They're just that constant nervous twitch. What's everybody else doing? Okay, is this the right? Okay, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, reassuring me, I'm okay. Yeah. That shiver, like the rabbit whose ears are always trembling. That's the citta. Yeah. You know? And when one sees it like that, and he remembers it like that, and you look at it with a heart, you think, oh dear. Let's not blame it. Let's not punish it. Let's not frighten it. Let's just be really gentle and steady and encompass that territory of uncertainty that is innate when the citta is focused on conditioned phenomena, because conditioned phenomena are insecure, uncertain, changeable, breaking up. There are no firm ground. And if we don't know where the firm ground is, there's always that shiver of anxiety and insecurity. In fact, you know, one of the ways that the realization experience is mentioned is kama, safe, and the abhaya, free from fear. And until one has touched into that to some extent, there's always anxiety of some kind is hovering. Yeah. And it's not a hindrance because in a way it's necessary. You know, we have to know that knives can kill us. We have to know that electricity is dangerous. We have to know that certain things will arouse people's anger. Yeah. And we don't want that. Yeah. And then so then there's that sense we have to have that ability to receive signals. The problem is that can be dealt with is when these signals become so embedded in the citta that we're living with that even when it isn't actually the cause of it isn't really there. We're imagining it. Yeah. And so, because the citta doesn't actually contact sense world, it contacts what the mind, the thinking mind, tells it. And the thinking mind describes things in accordance with the citta. So if the citta is nervous, the thinking mind looks at all the things to get nervous about, picks them up, broadcasts them back into the citta gets stimulated by something that's actually concocted or contributed to concocting. So the difference between the heart and the mind. The heart is naturally wavering. Then it sends a signal out to the thinking mind, tell us what's going on out there. Yeah. Look around at sight, sound, and interpret what other people are doing, so that I can get it right. It looks around and then the mind that's driven by the anxiety sees anxiety-forming phenomena. It looks at people, she's frowning. Oh dear, I must have said something wrong. Oh dear. Now maybe she's frowning just because she's got headache. So, you know, it sees and interprets things in accordance with the volitional tendency that the citta has given to it. So before we actually start to reify or see our world, we have to really contemplate where the citta is coming from. If it's coming from fear, we have to deal with that fear right here. Otherwise it spreads out. So our way of dealing with that is this is anxiety. Feels like this, mindfulness of that, aware of the citta, then the citta is shivering, getting tense, driven, and quality, skillful attention to that steadies, calms, widens. We recollect whatever is out there, I am living without hatred. And we take refuge in that. Whatever people say and think, I'm living with a mind of goodwill. That's my intention. You keep going back to that. And then when the citta then is properly dealt with its latent tendencies, then the signals shift. We say, oh, here are people who are suffering, people who are subject to anxiety such as me. They may be thinking unfortunate things about me. I will reassure them, rather than I will defend myself against them. So it's a very different relational impulse. Yeah, she's looking like she's a bit hostile, I will therefore reassure her. Rather than she's looking a bit hostile, I will defend myself against her and get ready to lash back and start justifying myself as soon as I see her. I've done this right, I've been on time, we start doing that. That's another fear signal. Warding off attack before it happens. But then when the fundamental signal of fear is there, we actually operate in ways that do not quell the fear, they just defend us from what we're frightened of. But they don't actually dispel the fear. The fear remains locked in the system. We're still defending ourselves against an unkind, unfriendly world. And I've done it well today. I've got a good job. But the world is still unfriendly. Because we haven't dealt with the root cause. So clearly there are distinct meditations, like the meditation on death is an antidote to fear. Whereas to the individual, it's a source of terror. The meditation on death means you bring yourself to that point, okay, contemplate this, do this on a daily basis, I forgive, express gratitude, release the past, open to the future, don't hold on. No future. Forgive, express gratitude. Get out of the tribunal of right and wrong. Had a chance to live. Thank you very much. Express goodwill. End of story. Yeah. Then the citta has got something to travel out of life with, something useful, rather than going out with fear and grudges and carrying past narratives. So even that, is a skillful state. The topic may be unpleasant, but if it's cultivated, it gives rise to a skillful state that lifts us. And you can feel that lift, the weight of anxiety and having to hold your own stuff together and be something or the other, just drop it. That's called a skillful state. And so what do we do when we do this sitting still stuff? what are you supposed to focus on? Again, you look in the suttas, the Buddha never teaches us to focus on particular points. Even when we're doing things like mindfulness of body, he says, just be aware of your body. Walking, standing, sitting, scratching, eating. It's not a particular point. It's just the sense of having this animated physicality that's earthy, that's got warmth, that moves around, it's intelligent, it's, you can dwell in it, it's a comfortable abiding place, make it comfortable, it's rhythmic, it's flowing. Just be in that. Because when you're in that, you're in the real, actual animated world rather than the world of symbols, concepts, possibilities, or to, might be in the future. The body doesn't do any of that. This is your first filter. You filter off future. You filter off status. You filter off identity. Yeah, because the body doesn't have it. Yeah. So you put aside social roles. Whether you're the king or you're baby, whatever, you've got same stuff. Body. Male, female, doesn't matter. So a lot of that sources of identity, the source of anxiety and the sources of becoming are removed at that level. And if you abide in that, that sense of that, the body as a single entity, then again the habit of the mind to try to focus on a particular point is constantly negated. Yeah. Because the sense is to keep the whole body in mind. If you try and walk focused on one point, what point are you going to focus on? Because it's a moving thing, isn't it? You've got to shift your legs, you've got to move the whole body together. And for it to be comfortable, it's got to be fluid. So it's not like robotic walking. Yeah. Right. So really consider these things. And when he says, okay, you know, sitting down and breathing, he doesn't say focus on the breath. He says focus on know the experience of breathing. Because breathing is something you don't have to do. It happens. It just arises. And it's lovely because it's refreshing. It's the most natural thing in the world. It opens your body up. You feel the energy flow through the body. You feel it softening when you breathe out. And it's a pause at the end of each out-breath where things just go very still and quiet. It happens by itself. You don't have to do it. Right? It's there, in your body. So then I try to teach a meditation, and people are trying to do breathing. And they were breathing fine before they started to be mindful of it. Once they got mindful of it, they had to get good at being breathing. They had to do the right kind of breathing to make sure they got the thing right, so they get the right point, and to make a constant effort to sustain it. And you're thinking, but this is driving you nuts, isn't it? I said, yeah, but I'll have the breakthrough. I'll get into samadhi. Well, let's check it out with the Buddha. He didn't teach us to do that. And the idea was, this is cool, this is easy, because everybody just breathes in and out and happens. And then, do you know what it is? Because certainly in the Indian understanding, breathing is several levels of it. There's the air breath, there's the energy breath, there's breath, so it's a five different breaths, five different systems. But they're basically, the whole system is just the flushing and the movement of energies. And just be with that, because it happens. We are inherited. That's our bridge to something mystical and transpersonal. And to be with it, you have to stop doing that holding on, screwing yourself up onto one point. So it definitely requires a kind of effort, but the effort to stay still and open and receptive. to something that's fluid and flowing. Now we, right? And it's felt. So you can read feeling and you can read how rigid you're getting by reading what's happening in your body. If you're breathing easy, if you're tight breathing, something's rigid. Or freezing up. Yeah. So then this is not the process. This could basically be that fruitful collecting, gathering, overflowing, brimming to further fruitful states. There's always just going to be the pushing and the comparing and the judging and the tangling and the straining and then the giving up. Wrong path. Once again, you know, one of the ways in which this, not just once, but many times, you know, the Buddha presented it, is your first ground is something like, well, he said, first of all, one of them is generosity, giving, that's a heart quality. Begin with giving. Because giving is both heart quality and also establishes a relationship. You know, I give to, either I give to a dog or I give to a human being, yeah. Or I give myself some credit, but dana, fundamental, absolutely fundamental, first step, do dana, because that's a heart quality. And everybody can do it, you don't have to be that pure, everybody does do it, we all enjoy it, it brings us together, do more, and refine it from just Christmas presents to wise advice, and to even freeing people from fear by being a loving, careful, wise friend. The fundamental gift of each other's humanity. To free up the fear, anxiety that's so endemic to human relationships. So that's our biggest gift. Without that, we don't really get fully established. Dana Sila. Sila, again, this is a, keep reviewing it, because when we get the thinking mind, you get into all kinds of disputes and concerns, and this right and that's wrong, and this is pure and that's pure, this is, and of course in the Vinaya, this is a dukkha, this is only a dukkha, you know, this is a pachitya, you got all these kind of things, you get debates over exactly what time dawn is and stuff like that. And of course you look in the Vinaya, it doesn't even tell you about dawn, just so we create particular objects to start getting tight about. And sometimes people attack each other over interpretations of the training rules. Scholastic throwing daggers over training rules. Who's purist? And then start, you know, then scold each other because you're not pure, or feel you've got to train people to be really pure. And it's all this kind of top-down blaming and contracting around particular points. But actually, what Sila as a development from generosity is the opening the relational field, yeah, to respect relational integrity, relational sensitivity. In the very fundamental golden rule, I don't do to others what I don't want them to do to me. I don't blame and criticize and attack others because I don't want that to happen to me. We understand fear and we want to move beyond it in our relationships. Every creature is frightened of other creatures. Let me be someone who does not harm Instead, let me be someone who brings comfort and reassurance. And if we cultivate that, then we train gladly rather than fearfully to correct my wavering mind, to get on top of my, you know, impulsive tendencies, my carelessness. I train gladly rather than fearfully. And that's a skillful state. Heart opens. So these are general themes to cultivate and refresh to make sure that when we're in this territory, we are looking through the right lens, the heart, right view, rather than the mind, thinking mind. We're understanding the course of that causes fruitful states to come to be, bhavana, and avoiding the course that tends to suffering and ignorance, bhava. We're moving from the personal, isolated entity into sensitive awareness of the whole human predicament. We're moving from individuality to trust in Sangha. And when we get down to it, trust in Sangha on this level has to be cultivated through being worthy of trust, being honorable, being respectful, each of us, and being generous and kind to each other. Then there can be no other way. Trust is bound to develop. Fruitful states are bound to come to be. Yeah. And when we consider our domestic situations, you know, how important it is to have that sense of care and attention, particularly as we get sick or old, you know, rather than being seen as a nuisance and a burden who's going to be chucked out, useless, someone who will be cared for, treasured, and making those gestures that are generous and loving, be for our welfare, the welfare of others, and the longevity of the Sangha. Any other way will lead to its decline. So offer these thoughts for your reflection, consideration, and again, just a part of my sila practice is to not just to not do, but to do. My doing is to open and try to bring presence and companionship into the whole field in which I am embedded. Monastic community, Buddhist community. So I hope could be for some way contribute to your welfare.